One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and welcome to our summer series, where each week we're bringing you the best conversations from our 2021 webinar series. And this time we're talking with Independent Senator Rex Patrick about unnecessary government secrecy, freedom of information laws, and the powers of the Senate to expose dodgy decisions and poor administration that the government battles to keep hidden from the public. This episode was recorded live on the 21st of July 2021, and things may have changed since recording. So Rex Patrick has been a senator for South Australia since 2017 when he was appointed to fill Nick Xenophon's seat. Originally a member of Centre Alliance, he left the party about this time last year to serve as an independent. Before his time in politics, Rex spent 11 years in the Navy, including serving on Oberon and Collins-class submarines and working as an electronics technician, a bit of a different background compared to most MPs and senators, I think. After leaving the Navy, he set up a small business training people in sonar and acoustics and wrote publicly on defence issues. And as a senator, he's really been a fierce advocate for his home state. His defence background has given him an edge when questioning ministers and public servants over the $90 billion future submarines program with thousands of South Australian jobs in the balance. And also when challenging that ubiquitous excuse for government secrecy, national security. Senator Patrick apparently spends weekends making and pursuing freedom of information requests, and he boasts a score of Rex Patrick 11, Governments 1, and he's still awaiting a decision from the Administrative Appeals Tribunal that might bump up that tally to 12-1. And obviously, with the title today, Keeping the Bastards Honest, he's not keeping any secrets of his own. And today he'll be in conversation with Bill Brown, who's our senior researcher at our Democracy and Accountability Program. And we're going to be touching today on how the powerful can be held to account through freedom of information laws, the Senate, and even the Constitution. And I think today's a really timely webinar given the recent revelations about the car park rorting scandal, or car porks, I think as Twitter has dubbed it, hot on the heels of sports rorts and other maladministration of government discretionary grants. So thank you so much for joining us today, Senator Rex Patrick. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure. I might just update you. My score is actually 11-0 now because I've appealed the one that I lost. So that's a cabinet matter, and there's some important issues around that. So we'll just have to see how we go there.
Yeah, excellent. So just to kind of kick us all off, I wanted to ask for your overall assessment of the state of, I guess, accountability for the government at the moment. What does that picture look like?
Well, in actual fact, there are many oversight mechanisms for government, and unfortunately, many of them are being frustrated. If I just went through some of them, there are some oversight mechanisms that are funded by the taxpayer and, in effect, are operated by government, and that includes things like the Auditor General, who does a fantastic job. We've also got people like the Ombudsman, the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, who has oversight or a watchdog role in relation to intelligence, and people like the Privacy Commissioner. Then we have, perhaps more formally or more independently rather, is the Senate, and the Senate can conduct oversight with a number of different tools given to us by Section 49 of the Constitution. That allows us to do things like ask questions of ministers at question time, ask questions of officials at estimates, conduct inquiries. Of course, in order to do that, you need 39 votes in the Senate. We have the ability to also order the production of documents. So we've got a number of tools in our toolkit in relation to oversight. Then, of course, there's the judiciary. The judiciary has a supervisory role over government if they exceed their power. Of course, that can be difficult. It can be costly. One of the things about courts, they can come up with orders that bind the government, so the government has to comply with court orders. But it takes a fair bit to actually get before a court, unlike a Senate inquiry where you can start with nothing and build up evidence. With a court case, you've got to at least have some evidence, a sufficient body of evidence to at least commence proceedings. Then, of course, we have the media, and the media keep an eye on the executive and on politicians and on the judiciary and on itself. So that's a great arm. And, of course, we've seen frustration there in relation to things like police raids and so forth, and also laws that seek to inhibit the freedom of journalists. Then we have another mechanism, which is a great mechanism because every Australian citizen can do this, and that is to put in an FOI, make inquiry about a particular topic, and the law as it stands is that every Australian has a legally enforceable right for access to government information. Of course, that information belongs to the people. It's paid for by the people. It's generated for public purpose. That is being frustrated, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. And the final one that I want to talk about or just briefly mention is whistleblowing. Whistleblowing is a great way of keeping accountability inside government, whereby if someone sees some misconduct, they can raise it and they can do so under a protection. Now, many of these things are broken. So we've seen the Auditor General, for example, being underfunded. We've seen the Senate not always exercising its powers fully and letting the government get away with things. We've seen issues with the judiciary in that it's hard to get access to a judicial ruling per se because it is quite an expensive proposition. We've seen the media being stifled by way of, as I mentioned before, police raids. We've seen FOI being stifled because governments have a culture of making cavalier claims that then have to be fought. And finally, with whistleblowers, we've seen terrible situations where we've had people like Bernard Collaery, Witness K, blowing the whistle, with David McBride in relation to Afghanistan. We've seen Richard Boyle in relation to the ATO. All of them are being prosecuted or might say persecuted by government authorities for the very fact that they blew the whistle. So I don't think we're in a good state. We do have many, many mechanisms and they all need to be fixed. And I might just end it by saying the big missing item we have is an ICAC, and that unfortunately the government promised that we're going to get an ICAC. They're basically running out the clock. We won't see an ICAC this side of an election.
Yeah, so many issues that you've touched on there, and I think we'd like to come back to most of them. Bill, I know you do a lot of FOIs for the Australia Institute. Do you have a question on that there?
Yeah, well, in particular, you mentioned the beauty of an FOI is that any citizen can do it. We've got hundreds of citizens watching today. I was wondering if you had some tips for people who've never put in an FOI before, kind of how do you realise that there's something worth asking about and how do you anticipate some of the ways that the government avoids answering those FOIs?
Okay, so working on the positive side of things first, thank you, Bill. Citizens just need to learn these words. This is a request for the purposes of the FOI Act 1982. I seek access to, and then dot, dot, dot. That's how easy it is to put in an FOI. And I run across many constituents who say to me, Rex, I've been trying to get a document of government, and I've asked them many times, and they keep promising. They keep telling me they're going to consider. When you use those magic words that I've just given to you, and put that in an email to a government department, they are obliged to give the document to you, and they're obliged to do so in the federal space within 30 days, unless there is a justifiable exemption, so that the default position is you have the right to see these documents. Unfortunately, what we see happening, however, is government departments make a range of very cavalier claims, ranging from national security. We've seen national security claims being made in relation to health information recently with vaccines. But we see lots and lots of cavalier claims that may not be properly made out. And unfortunately, many citizens stop there and think, oh, this is too hard. I've found if you pursue things, you can almost always, and as Ebony mentioned, my score is 11-0 at the moment in terms of appeals, you can almost always get access to the documents. You just have to get it away from the department to an independent body, either the Information Commissioner or the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, and you'll generally find that you'll get access to at least more of the document that you are seeking, and indeed often all of the document that you are seeking. Unfortunately, there are huge delays in the Information Commissioner world. It can take 2 to 3 years to get an FOI, and by that time, the information may well and truly just be useless. And that is a huge problem that we have with the FOI domain. And so there are some things that I'm doing in background. I'm actually considering, or almost certainly likely to lodge an application in the federal court in relation to my matters, using myself as the complainant to force the Information Commissioner to make decisions in a much more timely fashion.
And I know you've got a big court case on at the moment surrounding National Cabinet. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, so it's not strictly a court case, although it is being heard by a justice. When Scott Morrison invoked National Cabinet, that is, he pulled together himself and the premiers to enable them to talk about responses to COVID, and I point out I have no objection to that at all. I think that's a worthy idea. Unfortunately, what he did was he then declared that National Cabinet was a subcommittee of the federal cabinet, and in doing so, he wrapped a secrecy blanket over everything that National Cabinet talks about. Now, noting that the National Cabinet is talking about things like lockdowns, border closures, vaccines, restrictions of liberties, very important health issues. I think it's most unhelpful, and it's in fact most unreasonable to impose a secrecy blanket as he did. And so I went for the jugular. I requested under Freedom of Information Laws access to the minutes of a National Cabinet meeting, and indeed the notebooks of a National Cabinet meeting, knowing full well that they would come back and say, sorry, that's cabinet in confidence. When they did exactly what I thought they would do, I then appealed to the Information Commissioner saying, look, this is not a national cabinet, this is not a cabinet in the terms or in the normal understanding of a cabinet as per the FOI Act and the National Archives Act. That matter was quickly escalated to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. The government tried to keep it with the Information Commission, knowing that it would take 2 years to get through. Thankfully, the Information Commission said, well, this is a bit of a complex one. The Prime Minister argued, no, it's not complex and it should be decided with the Information Commissioner. But as soon as we got to the AAT, the AAT decided to appoint a justice to hear the matter. Justice White, who doesn't strictly appear as a judge, he appears as a presidential member, but his decision will have great weight. And of course, then the government appointed a QC, noting how simple the matter was, and then they on my side, and I have to give a big shout out to Jeffrey Watson SC and to Diana Tang, who works in Jeffrey's chambers. For then offering pro bono to assist me, noting it's a really important matter, basically going to the AAT and saying that the National Cabinet has none of the essential features of a cabinet. Those features would be that it's a minister, it's a meeting of senior ministers. Of course, there is only one federal minister at National Cabinet, that's the Prime Minister, all the rest are premiers. There is no cabinet collective responsibility or solidarity. So we see cabinet meetings taking place, and then we see press conferences by the Prime Minister, then all of the premiers all saying different things, and cabinets are not allowed to do that. If you disagree with cabinet, you are required to resign. That, of course, is not occurring. So it doesn't have the characteristics of a cabinet. Now, I'm now awaiting the judgment of Justice White. He's no doubt carefully pondering this, because the government have indicated already through their submissions that if they lose, they intend to appeal, and that would be a matter that would have to go to the full federal court.
It sounds like a really important case. And, of course, Geoffrey Watson used to be Council Assisting New South Wales, ICAC, so well steeped in all kinds of matters of accountability. So we await the outcome of that with great interest, because, of course, as you mentioned, the National Cabinet has just been making absolutely huge and consequential decisions for millions of Australians, and far less transparent than its predecessor, COAG. Bill, might come back to you for your next question.
Yeah, well, one thing we write a lot about at the Australia Institute is the Senate and its powers to hold the government to account. Of course, the House of Representatives has the same powers for the most part, but because it's controlled by the government, it's much less likely to exercise them. But your reference to needing 39 votes for the Senate Act as well made me think that maybe when I talk about the Senate's powers hypothetically, I'm overestimating what it can do in practice because of those requirements. So I'm wondering if you could tell us, when has the Senate acted successfully to increase transparency, but also when has it been more hesitant than you think it should be?
Okay, so thank you for the question. Look, the Senate is an awfully powerful beast. It has all of the powers of the House of Commons, or the powers that they had back in 1901, which are extensive. But as we've mentioned, you need 39 votes. The Senate has, there are 76 senators, and we need to have at least half plus one enable it to enact a power. So it's different to a judge, for example, who has tremendous powers to order things to occur, and he or she can do that unilaterally. But of course, they can only do it down a very narrow line dealing with the case that's before them, whereas the Senate can actually say, look, we want to look at anything we want to, but again, you need a body of people to agree with you. And so, you know, that's kind of an interesting difference in the powers. So it does create a difficulty. And this is a really important reason as to why we want to have a situation where no party has sole power in the Senate, because that would mean that, as you mentioned, the House of Representatives, which has all the same powers but never utilises them because the government always controls the vote, we don't want to ever see that in the Senate if possible. Now, the Senate can order the production of documents, it can subpoena people to appear before it, and it has all of the powers to enforce those its will, but you have to get past the fact that, you know, sometimes the Labor Party, in this instance in opposition, look at things and say, you know what, if that occurred and we were in power, we wouldn't like it. And I face that all the time. The words they use to me are, Rex, we are a party of government. You know, so they expect to be in government at some stage. So they're not always willing. Look, back in the 1950s, the House of Representatives, and it was a shameful act, actually, because it was about journalists who were writing bad things about the Prime Minister. The House of Reps put two journalists in jail, in the Goulburn Jail, and that went to the High Court, and the High Court said, yes, the House has the power to do that. Once we've established it's got the power to do that, we're not going to interfere with how it uses that power. So we have powers to be able to put people in jail if they don't comply with our orders. But stepping back from that, we can also issue a fine, the maximum fine being $5,000 under the Parliamentary Privileges Act. I think that needs to change. And in fact, right now there is a privileges matter before the Privileges Committee of the Senate, dealing with the Defence Department's refusal to hand documents to the Senate. And it's going to be a bit of a test case. Normally what happens is if an order is not obeyed, you can sort of work with the opposition and other crossbenchers to frustrate the government in dealing with bills. One, you might recall Jackie Lambie at one stage got enough votes behind her to make such that she could see into a Royal Commission report. We can do those sorts of things. We can hold up legislation. That's a political solution, but we also have formal contempt powers that we can use. Again, you have to have the will of the Senate to be able to exercise those powers. I think the Senate has lost its lost a bit of its mojo. I know that 2 years ago, the House of Commons was after some documents from Facebook. They had a gentleman come into the UK that had the documents because Facebook, sort of refused to hand them over to the UK Parliament. A gentleman came into the UK with the documents in a briefcase. The Sergeant of Arms was sent to a hotel and basically said to the person, "You've got to hand these documents over." He refused to. He was arrested and taken to the Parliament. And basically, told, "Look, you can hand the documents to us, or you can not leave." And in the end, they got the documents. Now that there's the House of Commons exercising its mojo, we haven't seen that here in Australia for some time, and it becomes problematic if we don't exercise our contempt powers, because we can end up with situations where, as some people think is the case now, where officials don't properly answer questions. The Senate could really give them a whack, but it, for whatever reason, it chooses not to.
We might come back to some of those Senate things, but I did want to touch quickly on intelligence agencies. I know for a number of years you've been pushing for kind of more oversight. The Australia Institute has done a little bit of research a couple of years back, looking at how other Five Eyes countries, for example, have oversight, the USA, UK and Canada in particular, and they've got different and sometimes more effective ways. And certainly we seem a lot more limited in our oversight of intelligence agencies than a lot of other countries. What needs to change there, and why is it important to have oversight of our intelligence committee?
Okay, so we do have some oversight of our intelligence services. If I look at some of those mechanisms I talked about before, there is the inspector. The primary method is the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, and that is a statutory position who has oversight of almost everything that the government or that the intelligence services do. There are some carve-outs, and they're important carve-outs. In the case of Bernard Collaery, whilst the Inspector General can look at what the intelligence agencies do, they have no. The Inspector General has no ability to question the orders of the National Security Security Committee of Cabinet, for example. If they direct something to occur, the Inspector General can't question that direction. So there are some limitations on what the Inspector General can do. There's, of course, judicial powers. I seem to recall during the Hilton bombing, or it might have been a raid that took place on a hotel as a part of a training exercise, where judicially that was dealt with. ASIS tried to resist cooperation with the court, and the court used its contempt powers, or used its powers to enforce its ability to have oversight of that particular operation. The difficulty is that we have a parliamentary committee, the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. It's a committee that has a carve-out in its legislation that says it can't talk about operational aspects. And that's a real problem. When we first started our intelligence services, they were relatively small, quite focused, not a lot of money involved. We now have a situation where there's something like 7,000 people employed in the intelligence domain, more than $2 billion per annum being spent on intelligence. We need to expand the Parliament's role in oversight. There's nothing constitutionally that stops the Parliament having oversight of our intelligence services. The Parliament itself chose to censor itself in relation to operations when it passed the PJCIS enabling legislation, which is the Intelligence Services Act. On several occasions, every time an intelligence-related law has gone through the Parliament, I have tried to amend the Intelligence Services Act to remove that censorship of the Parliament. Now, interestingly, the Labor Party have their own bill that seeks to do that, but on no occasion, on the many times that legislation has passed through the Parliament, the Labor Party ever backed my amendments, which is just a little bit surprising. I will say,
police have that power to examine operational matters. Is that like a unique Australian thing?
Yes, absolutely. So all of the Five Eyes countries can do that. Australia is an aberration in that respect. And can I just state, I'm really supportive of our intelligence service. I think they perform a very important role. But as you give them more power, and particularly powers that are exercised in secret, you have to enhance the oversight. And that has not been happening here in Australia.
Bill, did you have any other questions on intelligence agencies?
Yeah, I'm glad you talked about that kind of trust angle, because one of your proposals is for background checks for incoming ministers. And I guess my concern there is always that historically security agencies have been overzealous in how they surveil activists and radicals and so on. On the other hand, I take the point that it's hypocritical that the people at the highest level avoid these checks and everyone else gets subject to them. So I was wondering how you'd weighed up those considerations.
All right. So constitutionally, we can't have the executive refusing or basically stopping a senator or indeed a judge, the other two arms of our government and under our constitution, from carrying out their duties. So we don't security check judges and we don't security check MPs and senators. I am here by the will of the people, and the executive can't question that. However, in relation to ministers form a dual role, that they have two hats. One of them is as a parliamentary representative. The other is as a member of the executive, at the very top of the executive. So constitutionally, there's no issue. And in fact, Canada has done this. They security check their ministers. Now, people might be surprised that our defence minister, our attorney general, the prime minister, the home affairs minister, all get briefings of the very most sensitive data, typically on a daily basis, and none of them have security checks. And that I believe is a huge problem. And what my bill proposed was not to have the executive say, like they do for a public servant, you can or can't have a security clearance. Simply that when the Prime Minister appoints a cabinet minister, that the Director General of Security, that is the head of ASIO, would be required to produce a report for the Prime Minister. It would be very tightly held. It would be an offence to provide it outside of a very select group of people. And the Prime Minister could read that report, and then the Prime Minister could decide what he wanted to do. So it wouldn't be an executive decision, or at least an arm of government saying that that someone couldn't be a minister. That would fall with the Prime Minister. And the bill had protections that said if there was a change of government or a change of Prime Minister, the previous Prime Minister couldn't look back to those reports except in circumstances where they wanted to reappoint a same minister, and obviously an updated report could come. So there were lots and lots of protections. My bill was sort of modelled off what is done overseas and in Canada again. And I think it's really important that we do background checks. We've seen situations where, Sam Dastyari got himself tangled up with some Chinese players. And look, I know Sam. He made a mistake. It cost him his job. But we've seen Aldi bags being handed over full of cash to politicians. a whole range of things taking place in the political space. We should not presume automatically that our parliamentarians are squeaky clean. In fact, we know there are many, we've had some go to jail in the past, and there's certainly been questionable judgment and conduct in relation to perhaps even some of the cabinet ministers that we have now.
We might go very soon to questions from the audience, and I'll just note that we've got about 600 people on the line with us today. So thanks so much for tuning in. I can see a bunch of great questions here. But Bill, very briefly, I think you had a question about freedom of expression and the Constitution before we get to those.
Yeah, so you've brought a bill that would, I guess, trigger a referendum, amend the Constitution to introduce a freedom of expression as a constitutional protection. I guess we can all think of recent events that might have prompted that, but in particular, is there something that triggered your decision to pursue that?
Okay, yeah. So sometimes I wonder why it's my bills that are doing a lot of these transparency things. I think it's a shame that that others aren't putting these things up, because I think they are important. That bill that I put to the Parliament, I did so just after the media raids that took place with the ABC and News Corp with Annika Smethurst. And what happened immediately after that was the PJCIS, the Intelligence Committee, struck up their own inquiry looking at some aspects of media freedom and the effects of those raids. So too did the Senate. It struck up an inquiry into media freedom. And so what I did was I left my bill sitting on the back burner, and I really only raised it when last month we had a Justice of the High Court, Justice Stewart, make a statement in a judgment that he was of the view that freedom of expression was not in the Constitution. So as a black letter lawyer, he's looked at it and obviously decided that there is no freedom of expression or even from a political perspective written into the Constitution. Now, I want to be careful and say that I don't think Justice Stewart is someone who objects to freedom of expression. He's a judge and he looks at the law and he's just saying it's not there. He's not saying it's a bad it's a bad thing to have. And so it's after that judgment, immediately after that judgment, I thought it's timely, noting we've got a Justice of the High Court stating that we don't have freedom of expression, or it's his view at least, and that the High Court ought to reconsider this, that's the point at which you say, well, ultimately, if the High Court says something, it's for the Parliament to then act to remedy any particular issue that they may have with what a judicial officer says. Now, in this particular case, it's difficult because the Constitution can only be changed by the people of Australia. There's a process we go through, which is both Houses of Parliament must agree to a prospective change, and then, of course, the people will vote on it. And there is some other hurdles in relation to constitutional referendums. But, of course, then we get to the point where the people speak, and then everyone below that, the Parliament and, indeed, the High Court and other courts of Australia fall into line. Now, the great benefit of my bill, if it were successful, is that many of the recommendations of both the PJCIS report and indeed the Medium Freedom Report would, in fact, be resolved through a constitutional change, because all of the existing laws would then have to be looked at through the lens of a freedom of expression and freedom of the press that sat in our constitution. So it's a great way of putting a broom through the whole arrangement. It would fundamentally change things and hopefully rebalance things, in my view.
Mm. Well, that luckily leads us into our first question from the audience, which is from Stephen Masters. But before we get to that, I just wanted to plug our new book, The Nordic Edge, from the Australia's Nordic Policy, Australia Institute's Nordic Policy Centre, and I myself co-wrote a chapter on press freedom and media diversity, looking at the example of the Nordic countries, which, as the Senator has alluded to there, have much stronger protections for not only freedom of expression, but in particular press freedoms in their constitution, which is something that Australia lacks. And we've actually fallen down the rankings in terms of press freedom, while all the Nordic countries remain at the top. And part of the reason for that is not only the raids on journalists, as we've touched on here, but also the prosecution of and persecution of whistleblowers, as Rex has talked about as well. So available in all good bookstores. But that takes us to the first question from Stephen Masters, which is, why hasn't Australia enacted a Bill of Rights? And he also asked about an integrity commission, but I think that aligns neatly with what you were just talking about, your constitutional changes. Is a Bill of Rights what's needed for not just freedom of expression, Rex, but other freedoms as well?
Okay. I absolutely think we should have a Bill of Rights, but I have a Brett Whiteley painting of an elephant in my office in Parliament House. It's not my piece. It belongs to the people. It's on loan to me. But I look at it often and ask myself the question: yeah, how do you eat an elephant? And the answer, of course, is one bite at a time. The difficulty with a Bill of Rights, it is that it is very, very complex, and you have lots and lots of differing views. And therefore, it is hard to get to the point where everyone agrees. And we saw that. You know, Andrew Wilkie raised a bill a couple of parliaments ago, and great difficulty. And we see the difficulties when you have a clash of, for example, freedom of religion versus the rights and reasonable expectations about the LGBTQI community. It's hugely problematic. So I think there ought to be a Bill of Rights. However, I'm trying to eat this elephant one bite at a time, and so I look at the situation that's going on in relation to attacks on the media and on its freedom, and indeed things like what Justice Stewart has said, and I say, right, this is the bite we need to have. Mm. Just narrow it down to something where we might be able to get an outcome.
Yeah, excellent. So I think we've just cracked 600 people on the line with us. Thanks so much for joining us. If you have just tuned in, you can put your questions for Rex in the Q&A function here. And just a reminder, you can upvote people's questions and comment on them as well. I'm seeing a lot of questions from blokes here. So if we could upvote a couple of questions from women, that would make them easier for me to find. The next one is from Graham Turvey. He says, what do you think about Julian Assange being in jail in that case, and how the government, I'm adding in my thing here, how the government has or hasn't supported him?
Okay, it's a hugely important matter. I'm on record as saying that the government does need to intervene through government channels. There are manners, ways in which a call could be made, and governments could have Julian Assange returned to Australia. This is a freedom of press issue, it's unfortunate that, and it is difficult in the context that we generally respect the judicial proceedings in other countries and the rights of other countries to work around what they perceive to be criminal events, and so it's hard. It is hard to intervene in these proceedings, but I think the government hides behind that a little too much. There could be representations made that would put pressure on both the UK government and the US government to just back away. Look, Julian Assange, even if you don't like what he did, there are people that feel that he did the wrong thing. I'm not one of them. But even if you felt that way, he has gone through lots and lots of suffering as a result of what he did, without ever being put before a court. He has suffered, and I think the time for that suffering has ended.
Mm. Well said. I've got a couple of people asking here for you to repeat those FOI magic words again.
Okay.
We might also try and post them and send them around when we send people a link to the video. But just once again, those magic words.
Okay. The magic words are, this email is a request for the purpose of the Freedom of Information Act 1982. I seek access to ... There's a couple of other legal requirements, so you need to identify, if you can, what it is that you are seeking so that the search is not too broad. And you also have to include your name and a contact address. But that's all pretty simple. In the federal space, there may be a fee that follows. That will be decided upon depending on how voluminous and complex the task is. You will be consulted on that and have the ability to withdraw your application if you're confronted with the proposition of paying, you know, several hundred dollars for an FOI. That becomes your choice. By law, the government are required to assist you. So if you put in an FOI request, you don't quite get it right, they are obliged in law to consult with you to try and narrow down or better articulate what it is that you want. So very easy process. Instead of asking or complaining internally to yourself about the lack of information, everyone understands they have a legally enforceable right for access to all government documents unless there is an exemption that can be applied to those documents.
Thank you so much. The next question is from Sarah Barter. She says, after the UK MP's expenses scandal, as an apology to the public, the petition system whereby after 100,000 signatures, petitions are considered for debate in Parliament was introduced, as well as the Recall of MPs Act. In Australia, the scandals keep coming and 85% of voters think politicians are corrupt, but we haven't been given any of these mechanisms as an apology. Her question is, why do you think MPs in other countries actually feel they have to at least try and do better, whereas the ones here don't even seem to bother to try?
Okay, so look, that proposition of having a petition that invokes a debate is one that I support. It was one that actually my former employer, Nick Xenophon, actively sought out to do. So I'm on board. The difficulty again is, look, firstly, a lot of times when something occurs in the public eye that is wrong, oppositions and independents will call for a debate anyway. But I respect the right of an important right of people in a democracy to be able to cause a debate to occur. The problem is what flows from that, we end up back in that situation of the Senate being able to act on things, but only if there are 39 votes and only if there is, in effect, the will of the Senate. You know, sports rorts is a good example where people might recall it went to the wire. One of the things that we wanted to do was get access to that report. The government claimed it was cabinet in confidence. The Senate has never accepted cabinet in confidence as a reason not to have a document handed over. They might accept the thresholds higher, and that's consistent with the courts, who can also get access if it is sufficiently important for the purposes of justice to have access to cabinet documents. We called for the sports rorts document when it wasn't handed over. I moved a motion. It was a very interesting motion to have Matthias Cormann move from the table of the Senate, so where he sits in the middle opposite Penny Wong, to the front bench. So I just wanted to move him a couple of metres until such time as the document was handed over. I thought that would be a nice visual signal that whilst he was sitting on the front bench, everyone would know the sports rorts document hadn't been handed over. There was a huge behind-the-scenes outcry. If people were ever to see the conversations that took place via text when from Matthias to me when that occurred, quite lengthy and legal, legally focused discussions. But we actually got a motion signed by the leader of the opposition, Penny Wong, Larissa Waters, as leader of the Greens, by Centre Alliance, as I was a member of then, and One Nation and Jackie Lambie. We had the numbers to do it, but the government worked really hard behind the scenes and we, you know, I lost two of the votes at the last minute, and the motion failed. But again, if the Senate exercises its powers, we can do a lot. So I'm all in favour of a citizen invoked debate in the Parliament, but we must also look at the back end to make sure that we can do things about it when issues arise.
Mm. The next question is from Fred Sim. He says, what can we do to protect whistleblowers and strengthen the public interest over secrecy?
Okay, we do need a change to our whistleblower legislation. People might recall that in 2016, and this was a direct result, again, of my former employer, Nick Xenophon, there was an inquiry into whistleblowing after the ABCC legislation passed through the Senate. Nick got a committee up that looked at whistleblowing. The committee came out with a bipartisan report. There was an agreement in place that the government would reform corporate whistleblowing laws, and they did that in the last parliament. I took the lead on that with Kelly O'Dwyer, who eventually ended up in a pretty good place, supported by people like the Australia Institute, people like AJ Brown up in Queensland, who's an expert on some of these integrity matters, whistleblowing matters. There was a last element that needed to be fixed, and that was whistleblower legislation, the Public Interest Disclosure Act, the federal act. It does not provide sufficient protection. Richard Boyle is a case in point. So too is David McBride. And, of course, we've seen Witness K and Killeary as well, although their matter in some sense predated the Public Interest Disclosure Act of 2013. We have to change that act. I went and saw Matthias Cormann at the start of this parliament, reminded him of his obligation. Very shortly thereafter, Christian Porter made a statement saying they were going to change the whistleblower legislation. I've recently reminded Michaela Cash of the government's commitment or promise, at least there, but it seems to be that it's going the same way as ICAC, and that the government is not lending sufficient weight to those reforms. And, you know, it's the job of me and everyone to put pressure on government to meet its commitment that was made.
Mm. Bill, is there anything you'd like to add on how Australia approaches protection of whistleblowers?
Just to reiterate what the senator said, I think we've seen the benefits that it can bring, for the tax office, it's small businesses affected. For East Timor, it's our relations with a country that we, in the 1990s, sent soldiers over to defend or to secure its independence. So, it seems so fundamental that we need to address it.
Can I just add, in the United States, they have bounties for people who blow the whistle. So if you blow the whistle on your own corporation that is conducting a tax fraud or evading tax, and the Internal Revenue Service prosecute that person and they get back $100 million in tax, they may give the whistleblower $20 million. And they may do so secretly. That whistleblower may remain working in the tax office with his yacht and his mansion and all those other things. And that is it's not that we want to actually reward people with bounties. It's just the idea that everyone in a corporation, everyone in government are looking over their shoulder saying, you know what, if I do something wrong, there's a financial incentive for people to dob on me. And the bigger my indiscretion, the bigger the incentive is for people to dob people in. I probably shouldn't use that word because it has negative connotations here in Australia, but people who blow the whistle are heroes in my view.
And the government certainly seems happy for Australians to dob on one another for breaches of welfare and all other kinds of things, but never at the highest levels.
Unless it's JobKeeper.
That's right. The next question is from Holly Raish. She says, how can the Secretary of the Prime Minister and Cabinet refuse to submit documents to the Senate? I'm not quite sure what that refers to. Maybe you know.
Okay, so there have been times where the Senate has called for documents to be produced, and the process is a three-stage process. The first part of the process is that the Senate receives a motion, or a motion is put before the Senate to order the government to produce a particular document. That is voted on. If there are 39 votes or more, then the order is made and the government have to respond to that order. Now, it is permissible, and this is stage two, for the government to look at what the document is and decide that it is not in the public interest to release the document. It might be an intelligence document, or might be extremely sensitive from a commercial perspective, in which case they come back to the Senate and advance a public interest immunity. Now, often that's where it stops. The Senate then says, okay, some people might complain, some senators may complain, but then they let it rest. The next step, and I've exercised this on a few occasions, the next step is to actually go back through a motion in the Senate to say that the Senate does not accept the public interest immunity, and that is the final word. And that doesn't always happen, because some people look at what the government has claimed and say, well, that's fair enough. Now, on a number of occasions, and I'll give you a couple of examples, one of them is tax-related information. There are secrecy provisions in the tax law that prevent the tax office handing over documents to a minister, for example, so that a minister can't go and pry into a company's tax situation. But it's actually explicitly stated in the legislation, not that it had to be, but they explicitly put it in there, that a committee of the parliament, or the parliament, a house of the parliament, can call for those documents. Now, the tax office resisted that order for production. I then took it to the next step, which was to have the Senate vote that they were required to hand it over. In the end, the tax commissioner, Commissioner Jordan, said no, basically in the face of the Senate, was in contempt. The Senate had another motion that was passed that reminded him that it was a contempt, and they would take action. And with some arm twisting behind the scenes, the documents were eventually handed over. We've got a situation right now in relation to defence, where defence has refused to hand over documents. There has been some arm twisting behind the scenes, and there has been some concessions made by the government. But nonetheless, the government, the Department of Defence, has frustrated a committee of the Senate, and that matter is now before the Privileges Committee, which has taken submissions from the committee from the people who've been accused of fettering the Senate in its operation. And indeed, I've made a submission to the committee, which is at this stage confidential, but hopefully will be made public in due course.
Thank you. The next question is from Rosemary Lee, but there's a couple of other people who've asked similar ones, and it's on the new proposed changes to the ACNC Act governing not-for-profits and charities that many see as a kind of an attempt to silence charities from engaging in advocacy and potentially risking losing their charity status. And the question is, as we rely on these organisations to investigate, inform, educate and advocate in a lot of situations that would not otherwise the public would not be aware of, can you tell us where that legislation is at currently?
Well, I understand it is before the Senate, and look, I'm remiss. I don't know whether or not it's gone to a Senate inquiry. I suspect it will have. My position in relation to that particular bill is no. I would have to be persuaded by the government in some way. So I have a starting position of no. I think the government will have difficulty getting that through the Senate. So the Greens are not supporting, the Labor Party is not supporting. The government's going to have to work on the crossbench. I'm highly unlikely to support that legislation.
Thank you. A couple of other questions around the proposed federal ICAC, which, as you've mentioned, is nowhere at the moment. In terms of some of the flaws with what the government is proposing, could you just take us through, separate from, you know, that it's kind of on the back burner, there was some pretty serious flaws identified with the government's proposed model. Do you have concerns about that?
Look, I do. I understand that there are many people that do have concerns about ICACs, and there have been times when ICACs have overstepped the mark. One of them was with Margaret Keneen in New South Wales as a public prosecutor. ICAC investigated her when they really shouldn't have. It was in relation to a matter that wasn't to do with her with her role as a Crown prosecutor. The High Court basically ruled that ICAC had overstepped the mark. And so, like all bodies, we have to make sure there are the right checks and balances in place. And there are people that are concerned about the reputational damage that is done through these ICACs. As you mentioned before, Geoffrey Watson SC was lead counsel in relation to the Eddie Obeid matter, which has just been handed down to the New South Wales courts, that where they were found guilty of the very thing that ICAC had alleged. So, final closure on that particular issue. The thing about ICACs, and this is something that people need to understand. The reason you set up an ICAC instead of just have a police investigation is ICACs generally have powers that are would otherwise be considered unreasonable, powers that are designed to punch through the big firewalls that government departments sit behind, it's for that reason that these commissions. They never find anyone guilty of corruption because they're not able to. They're not a judicial body, but they also rely on evidence that would otherwise not be admissible in court. So people need to understand an ICAC is different to the police in terms of investigating because of the tremendous powers they have. That's recognised by saying that the ICAC can't judicially find someone has committed a crime. The matter then has to be referred to a court, and of course some of the evidence that the ICAC may have gathered, phone taps, those sorts of things, may not be admissible in a court. So all a corruption commission ever does is call someone out for being corrupt, and that is a reputational call and generally results in people resigning and possibly then being charged. We have to find the right balance between making sure that there's no undue reputational damage, but that's all very achievable, making sure that we don't investigate publicly, at least until such time as there is a prima facie case. Those sorts of things can all be done. The current bill does not go far enough, doesn't allow for people to pick up the phone and say, hey, there's an issue. It simply doesn't allow for things like public hearings. I think all of those are essential in various different circumstances. And you can make the legislation such that those sorts of public hearings only take place when the commissioner thinks it's appropriate. So there's still the ability to have sort of secret hearings. Of course, there are always limitations with secret hearings. That's sort of inconsistent with principles of open justice that we have here in Australia. There's lots and lots of parts to this. The Australian Institute has done a lot of work on this, so their model is a very good model, would, in my view, needs to be tweaked a little bit, but it's a great starting point. But actually the most important thing is we've got to get the will of the government, who simply are not motivated to have a commission against corruption. That's the fundamental problem we've got at the moment.
Mm. That's an excellent summary. Thank you very much. And people can find that. We've got our principles for the design of a federal ICAC available on australiainstitute.org.au. And some of those coercive powers that Rex was talking about there are because the nature of corruption is obviously that it's very secret. Sometimes it does involve people at the highest levels of government or the public service with the ability to cover up their crimes. And sometimes corruption isn't a crime or necessarily an illegal act, things like nepotism and things like that. So there's very good reasons why it has those coercive powers, but also why, as Rex alluded to, you can't necessarily always use it to build a criminal case against someone. I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up there. There were some really fabulous questions in there. I tried to get across a good cross-section of issues, but as always, I'm really sorry that we couldn't make it to all of them. Thanks so much for your participation today, Rex. We really appreciate your time.
It's a topic I love.
Excellent. And thank you, Bill, as well. I appreciate you coming on board. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
This has been a special webinar episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel, which you can find at australiainstitute.tv. All our latest research and content is at our website, australiainstitute.org.au, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and this episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and you can find her at Jennifer Macy. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you for listening to Follow the Money, and have a great summer.